Members of the House, comes to questions for oral answer. First question is in the name of Mark Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Before I start, Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the ACT Party, it's great to see the member, Kiritopu Allen, back in the House. And we, as the ACT Party, wish you all the very best.
The usual way is to either seek leave or take a point of order, but the member needs to now come to the question.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister for Conservation, is the Minister confident that the $1.1 billion nature-based jobs funding will deliver 11,000 jobs?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Kiritopu Allen.
For the components that I am responsible for, yes.
Supplementary. What is the total number of full-time equivalents currently employed as a result of the $1.1 billion Jobs for Nature program?
Mr. Speaker, I thank the member for his question. As he may be aware, the Jobs for Nature program is comprised of a number of departments, of which I have responsibility for the Department of Conservation component. That component comprises $501 million of the total pool, to which the July 2020 undertaking was to create 4,800 jobs. To date, in the year that program has been announced, we are making fantastic progress with over 1,084 people strapping their boots on up and down this country to be employed to date in DOC projects.
Supplementary, the Honourable Jackie Dan.
Does the Minister think it is acceptable that, according to the government's own publicly released figures, it is costing the taxpayer $820.60 for every hour of work produced by the Jobs for Nature initiative?
Mr. Speaker, I thank the member for her question and the research she's undertaken to get to that point. But what I will note is that this is a significant project, of which the evolution and the genesis of this project was undertaken when our country was in an economic crisis as a consequence of COVID. When the program was established, the Treasury was forecasting that jobs would be at a point of 10% unemployment by November. So what we had to do and what our government did do was essentially take a department like the Department of Conservation and require it to quickly pivot to form relationships at ground, in place across the region, to get this project into the place where we are today, where we are on track to meet our objectives of getting 4,800 people into jobs over the 4 years.
Point of order, the Honourable Jackie Dan.
Mr. Speaker, my question was very clear and succinct. Does the Minister think it is acceptable that, according to her government's own figures, it is costing the taxpayer $820.60 for every hour of work? The Minister told us many things but did not address the question.
I think the overall context of the answer, though, addressed the very question.
Supplementary.
Point of order, the Honourable Jackie Dean.
Seek leave to table a document, progress on creating jobs, progress on allocated funding, and a spreadsheet which lays out how the figure of $820.60 cost per hour of each job
and the
for Jobs for Nature is arrived at.
Yes,
these are the government's own figures, and this is my own work.
Is it publicly available?
This is now. These are.
Yeah, it's not. It's not in order to present documents that members have created themselves. Mark Cameron.
Supplementary. Why is the government not recording the cost per full-time equivalent job of the Jobs for Nature program, according to the response to returned question 24742, bracketed 2021?
Mr. Speaker. The cost per job is... there are many factors that go into the cost and the raw figures that the member's referring to. There are capital costs that we lay over. There's the nature of the role. So though all of those costs are taken into consideration when we provide the raw figure of cost per job, of which we are providing, and it is on record.
Supplementary.
Mark Cameron.
Does the Minister think that 10 projects currently on the Jobs for Nature website, which employ 192 people at a cost of $443,000 per job, is a prudent use of taxpayer money?
Mr. Speaker, I am not sure where the member has got that 433,000 per job. But what I can say, Mr. Speaker, is that we have to date made incredible progress by establishing, by getting people up and down this country into over 1,000 jobs. The cost for those jobs will vary. We have had, of course, the upfront implementation costs that you'd expect with any brand new project, but to date we are satisfied that this project is going to be cost effective and meet the targets that we have projected to date.
Timothy Coffey.
Question to the Minister. How is the Department of Conservation's Job for Nature investment helping tourism operators impacted by COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker. This is an excellent question from the member, and particularly in his patch, where tourism, and particularly in places like Rotorua, Queenstown, where we had significant upheaval in labour workforce during that period of time where COVID has disrupted those industries. It means that tourism operators, alongside our decision to extend the concession fee waivers out for another 6 months, that we are, supporting those operators to ongo their activities. Predator-free South Westland, which we announced in March, is an ambitious project that aims to restore nature and sustain jobs in COVID areas. It is the biggest step yet on mainland Aotearoa towards predator-free 2050 goal. Predator-free 2050 goal. Thank you, but so much.
Rachel Brooking.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. How does Jobs for Nature deliver skills and training benefits?
Great question from the member, Mr. Speaker. And look, training and upskilling is a significant component to our Jobs for Nature project. Essentially, every person that comes into a Jobs for Nature program, we expect that they will come out more upskilled than they came in. Training and capability development is enhancing the future of the workforce, and the types of skills required will vary from project to project. Many workers will gain practical skills, conservation skills, such as out there on the job, vegetation, weed control, might be chainsaw licences, grow safe certification, or what is specific to that project. So we are very proud of the work that is occurring up and down this country to upskill New Zealanders to make sure that they are committed to be our next generation of conservation warriors, sir.
We come to question number two in the name of Dr. Shane Leety.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Health, what is his plan to manage current demand for health services around winter illness, and how has he assured himself that district health board services are safe?
Speaker. The Honourable Andrew Little.
Mr. Speaker, in response to the first part of the member's question, our health system is there to deliver health services whenever people need them. As that member well knows, it is not uncommon to have spikes in particular infections, especially during winter, and that's what is happening now. In response to the second part of the member's question, I have assured myself that the district health boards are safe because this government funds them properly, in contrast to that member's party in government.
Supplementary. Which DHBs, if any, have had to manage admitted patients in hospital corridors and playrooms in the past month due to demand?
Mr. Speaker, the district health boards are there to make sure that they provide the services that are needed. It is not uncommon for there to be winter spikes in infections. The DHBs plan for that, are prepared for it, and right now they are putting their plans in action to provide safe services for the babies who are needing their help because of RSV.
Supplementary. How many of the 11 sick babies, if any, are still being cared for in a playroom at Middlemore Hospital as they were when reported last week?
Mr Speaker, as I understand it, the hospital took the step of taking an available space, removing the toys and the chairs and making it available as a place for babies when they came in for their initial attention from that hospital as they were prepared. A decision was made about whether they needed to be admitted or not. And that is a standard practice that hospitals do, particularly when there are winter spikes in infection.
Supplementary. What is the government's plan, if any, for the growing number of children presenting with respiratory syncytial virus, RSV?
Mr Speaker, governments don't take clinical decisions on particular infections, but what we do do is make sure that we invest properly in the health system. So whereas the previous government, over 9 years, increased health funding by $3.7 billion, this government, in less than 4 years, has increased funding by over $4 billion. And whereas the previous government invested roughly $1 billion over 9 years in government, we have invested more than $5 billion to upgrade facilities because of the sheer and utter neglect by the previous government.
Supplementary. What actions, if any, has he taken to improve the nurse-to-patient safety ratios in our hospitals as they come under increasing pressure from winter illness?
Mr Speaker, unlike the previous government, this government entered into an agreement with the DHBs and with the New Zealand Nurses Organisation to look at safe staffing levels, to implement a program called Care Capacity Demand Management. 10 DHBs have now fully implemented that program. 10 are left to go. But this is a government that takes seriously the concerns by our health workforce who were neglected by the previous government.
Supplementary. Do DHBs have enough funding to cope with the current surge in demand due to winter illnesses like RSV, given this year's budget cut operational DHB funding by 30% compared to last year?
Mr Speaker, that memory is completely and utterly incorrect. And when you look at that party in government's track record of funding hospitals compared to ours, it simply does not compare. So we increased funding for hospitals this year by roughly 4.4%. The average level of increase by the previous government was roughly about 1%. I stand on the record of this government, its commitment to health and to safe health services for all New Zealanders.
Question number three, in the name of Dr Duncan Webb.
Good morning, Mr Speaker. My question is for the Minister of Finance. What recent reports has he seen on the New Zealand economy?
Oh, Mr Speaker, I know that this is a popular moment in the day for everybody. The government's efforts to secure the recovery has been recognised once again by the global ratings agencies. S&P Global Ratings said in its mid-year update released yesterday that New Zealand's strong fiscal and monetary response to the pandemic, as well as the confidence in the government's public health measures, have seen the economy recover much faster than expected. The ratings agencies expects New Zealand to outpace its peers in the Asia-Pacific region, noting that economic activity has returned to its pre-pandemic trend in early 2021, making New Zealand one of the first countries to do so.
Supplementary. What impact has the economy's recovery had on the labour market?
Mr Speaker, the government's efforts to secure the recovery are reflected in the jobs market, which is going from strength to strength. The SEEK New Zealand employment report increased by 1% in June from the previous month to another record high for job advertising numbers. For the year, job ads rose to 115%, while job ad numbers are now 24% above pre-COVID highs. Mr Goldsmith, you don't want to go there. On a trend basis, job ads were above pre-COVID levels for all regions. Unemployment has fallen to 4.7%. And while there are challenges for businesses in finding workers, this is in fact a reflection of a stronger than forecast economic activity and the economy operating above pre-COVID levels. The government will continue to work with businesses to support them as the recovery continues.
Further supplementary, what other reports, as you've seen on the New Zealand economy?
Thank you very much, Mr Speaker. The latest global dairy trade auction shows prices are consolidating and actually declining 3.6%. The easing in prices comes after strong gains earlier in the year, which is in turn due to robust global demand for New Zealand dairy products. Economists are saying that the decline in prices is partly due to strong milk production, which rose 9.3% in May compared to the same month a year ago. For the entire 2020-21 season, production rose 2.7%. Commentators expect dairy payouts to farmers to retain near historic highs in the new season, which is positive for farm incomes, positive for the regions and positive for the economy overall.
Question number four, in the name of Andrew Bailey.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Revenue. Does he stand by the Minister of Finance's statement on 23rd March 2021 that deducting interest expenses from rental income is a, quote, tax loophole, unquote, and what assurances, if any, has he sought that increasing tax on landlords won't lead to renters being forced out of their homes?
Mr Speaker.
The Honourable David Parker.
Yes, and as landlords who invest in new homes will be able to deduct interest expenses, the premise of the second part of the member's question is incorrect.
Supplementary. Does he agree with the official advice that 75% of renters can't afford to service a mortgage, and as a result of the policy changes, quote, the most vulnerable group in our housing system, unquote, now face the risk of having their tenancies terminated, and if not, why not?
Mr Speaker, I do agree that renters generally cannot afford a mortgage, otherwise most of them would choose to buy a house rather than rent it. But in respect of the idea that this rule is somehow going to decrease housing stock, it's a nonsense argument, because if a landlord did choose to sell a house, it will either be to an owner-occupier. That owner-occupier will either be freeing up another house or will be a renter who all of a sudden is able to buy a house. And if the member somehow thinks that the house is going to disappear, well, he's just wrong.
Supplementary. Does he agree a tax of around $9,000 for the average property rental property owner, due to the removal of interest deductibility, will increase rents, including for low-income renters, who officials advise are the most vulnerable group in our housing system?
No, I don't agree that that is necessarily the outcome, as evidenced by the fact that when interest rates went down so remarkably over recent years, they increased rents rather than put them down.
Supplementary. Can he provide assurances to vulnerable low-income renters that as a result of his policies, they will not be evicted as warned in official advice?
Well, the idea that landlords would somehow come up with a pretense to evict a tenant because of changes to tax rule is absurd.
Supplementary. Can he provide an assurance to owners of new build-to-rent developments that are held with the express purpose of being rented out for the long term, 10 to 20 years, that they will be allowed to deduct interest against their rental income?
In respect of new builds, yes, and we're consulting on the details of that. One of the issues being consulted about is whether the period for which a new build can have interest deductibility. Sorry, I might have misunderstood the question, but answering as I understand it, one of the issues we're consulting about is whether that period should attach to the first purchaser or to the building for a period of years.
Supplementary. If public feedback on the interest deductibility consultation document due next Monday is overwhelmingly negative, as suggested by the 15,000 people who signed the petition I received yesterday, will he reconsider his policies?
Mr Speaker, we're consulting on the detail of it rather than the principle, which is already working.
Members, we come to question number 5 in the name of Dr. Liz Craig.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Health and asks, what recent announcements has he made on the Like Minds, Like Mine campaign?
The Honourable Speaker. Andrew Little.
Mr. Speaker, on Monday I announced the relaunch of the internationally acclaimed Like Minds, Like Mine program. The new Nuku Te Ao Like Minds program builds on more than 2 decades of work to continue to put the spotlight on stigma, prejudice and discrimination against those who experience mental health and wellbeing issues. $8 million over 5 years has been invested in a range of initiatives with Nuku Te Ao, Like Minds, to generate a social movement against prejudice, which includes education campaigns, social action grants and strengthening research and evaluation.
So what does the campaign comprise?
Mr. Speaker, the Like Minds, Like Mine program was established back in 1997. It was one of the first comprehensive campaigns in the world to counter the prejudice and discrimination associated with mental distress. This relaunched campaign addresses the inequity experienced by Māori and Pacific peoples who experience mental distress, especially young men. Nuku Te Ao, Like Minds, is now based on Kaupapa Māori principles and has a strong focus on equity. This is to ensure the initiatives within the program are effective for those communities who are more often facing discrimination. Nuku Te Ao, Like Minds, adds another tool in the toolkit for New Zealanders experiencing mental distress.
So what will this campaign do for those experiencing mental distress?
Mr. Speaker, the program focuses on the people who are most affected by mental distress and discrimination, including, as I said, Māori and Pacific communities. Nuku Te Ao, Like Minds, will help change attitudes towards people experiencing mental distress. It will help to reduce discrimination and improve social inclusion experiences for priority groups. We know that one of the population groups hugely overrepresented in our suicide numbers are young Māori men, and we need to reach out to them. We will go a long way as a country to address our ongoing mental health challenges if we are understanding and also comfortable talking to each other about experiencing mental distress.
Question number 6, Simon Watts.
Mr. Speaker, to the Minister of Health, how many unfilled vacancies are there in total across the district health boards, and how many of those vacancies are for nurses?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Andrew Little.
Mr. Speaker, I'm advised that as at the year ending 31 March 2021, there are approximately 3,387 full-time equivalent vacancies across all district health boards. I note that this includes corporate vacancies and represents 5.1% of the total number of full-time equivalent positions in 2019. In response to the second part of the member's question, I'm advised that as at the year ending 31 March 2021, there are approximately 1,168 full-time equivalent vacancies for nurses. I note that the figures that I have used today exclude the Waikato DHB. That DHB has recently advised that numbers that it previously supplied, which I had reported to the House on, had discrepancies that they are now working to resolve. In the long term, we are reforming the health system as a single Health NZ organisation that will allow us for true national planning of our workforce and allow us to start investing in and building the workforce we need for the future.
Supplementary. What does he say to aged care providers who are reporting district health boards are poaching their staff, resulting in over 500 vacancies in nursing alone under his watch?
Mr. Speaker, I say that the problems that the aged residential care sector are suffering are similar to the problems that other aspects of the health sector are suffering. There is a shortage of nurses. That is why we're working seriously with the nurses' organisation and the DHBs to get the remuneration package right. That's why we also worked on the safe staffing agreement and why we will also work on a recruitment campaign. But the reality is, when we deal with the remuneration issues with nurses in the public sector, it will have implications for nurses in primary care and aged residential care, and we will need to work with the employers in those sectors to make sure that what we do for our entire nursing workforce is in the best interests both of nurses and the population of New Zealand as a whole.
Supplementary. Why has he not taken any urgent action when health providers, including district health boards and aged care facilities, have been crying out for his help with this crisis?
Mr. Speaker, the member is totally and utterly incorrect, and plenty of action has been taken. When you have a look, for example, at the exemptions that have been granted to people to cross our border to pick up work, particularly in our health workforce, 43% of those exemptions are for people going into our health workforce. When you look at the investments that we have made in ongoing personal development and upskilling and training and places in DHBs for new graduates, new nurse graduates from university programs for nursing, we have invested considerably more. So plenty of action to create more places to fund more people into those roles, but it is true we still have a shortage.
Supplementary. Has he shared the healthcare sector's, including DHB's, concerns on government immigration policy to the Minister of Immigration? If not, why not?
Mr. Speaker, I refer that member to my previous answer.
Andrew. What is he doing to support health providers, including district health boards, who are critically short-staffed because workers are being pulled into the government's COVID-19 vaccination rollout?
Mr. Speaker, that member thinks it's a bad thing that we have a vaccination program that people actually have to work on, in which case he should go to the public and tell them that. The member can't have it both ways. We have a health service that has to do a large number of things. First of all, it has to pick itself up from the disaster left by the previous government, and we're in the process of doing that. And now we have a pandemic that we have to respond to, and we have the usual spikes and winter infections that we have to deal with as well. All of those things are being dealt with. We have challenges in that sector. The workforce challenges are part of that. But I do note that we are facing that challenge square on, which is something that the previous government simply failed to do.
That's right.
Question number 7, Willow Jean Prime.
My question is to the Minister for Women. What recent progress has she seen on the representation of women in the on public sector boards?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Jean Tonetta.
4 years ago, this government set a target to reach 50% of women's participation on public sector boards and committees. I am pleased to inform the House that we have met that target. This change has been championed by this government, but also has been about a huge drive for change in New Zealand's governance and leadership structures. Thank you to everyone who has been part of this vision.
Yeah, yeah.
Supplementary. What other diversity indicators were reported?
Mr. Speaker, this is the second year we are able to report on representation for Māori, Pacific and ethnic members. The Ministry for Women partnered with the Ministry for Pacific Peoples, the Ministry for Ethnic Communities, to collect ethnicity data. While I want to make sure we take time to celebrate what we have achieved, going forward, I've asked for a stronger focus for the underrepresentation of groups such as Wahine Māori, Pacific people, the Rainbow Community, people with disabilities and other ethnicities on our boards. It is important, Mr. Speaker, that our boards look like the communities they serve.
Supplementary. What else has this government delivered for New Zealand women?
Mr. Speaker, as the Minister for Women, I can tell you that this government has delivered for New Zealand women.
Yeah, yeah.
We've extended paid parental leave from 18 to 26 weeks, introduced domestic violence leave, provided free period products in schools, passed the Equal Pay Act, improved breast and cervical cancer screening, raised sole parent benefits and reinstated the training incentive allowance. This is to name just a few. This is a government that is committed to gender equality and a government that has delivered for women.
Yeah.
We now come to question number 8 in the name of the Honourable Julianne Centre.
Tēnā koe, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Energy and Resources. How many new permits for oil and gas exploration have been granted in Aotearoa since the government declared a climate emergency?
The Honourable...
Mr. Speaker.
Dr. Megan Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. No new offshore permits for oil and gas exploration have been issued since the 2nd of December 2020, when a climate emergency was declared. Two onshore permits were issued as the outcome of Block Offer 2019. These permits are the result of the agreed policy decision of the three parties that made up the previous government in 2018 to stop issuing new exploration permits for offshore acreage and to hold block offers for onshore acreage in Taranaki in 2018, 2019 and 2020.
Supplementary. Has she seen the latest report from the world's leading agency on energy, the IEA, stating that all countries must cease new oil and gas exploration and development now if we are to limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius?
Mr. Speaker, yes, I did, and I read that report with a great deal of interest. It is an important document and an important shift to see from the IEA. But I do note that the previous government, of which the Green Party were part of, made a policy decision to hold onshore block offers in 2018, 2019 and 2020, and the two permits that were issued on the 29th of June of this year are the outcome of Block Offer 2019.
Given the world's leading energy agency is saying that new oil and gas cannot be part of the pathway to avoid catastrophic climate change, will her government continue granting permits for exploration that will add to the global supply of fossil fuels?
Mr. Speaker, as per the decision that the previous government, made up of the Labor Party, New Zealand First and the Green Party, the decision was made by that government that a block offer would be offered in 2018, 19 and 20. There is a two-year lag of decision makings of permits, so there is a possibility for a further round. The future beyond that, there are no firm decisions have been made. A number of factors will be having to take into control, ranging from security of supply through to the context of the carbon budgets, but also important conversations to be had with iwi.
Supplementary.
Barbara Kruger.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So, to the Minister, in the government approval of these latest exploration permits, does the Minister now understand that gas is a far better transition fuel than Indonesian coal?
Mr. Speaker, in response to the member, what I would like to hear from that member's party is what their pathway to a decarbonisation of our economy looks like. They seem to be a party that is stuck in climate denial.
In order. The volume has increased to the point where I can't hear the answer, so I'm going to ask...
Supplementary.
I'm on my feet. Yeah. So I'd ask members to be a bit quieter.
Supplementary.
The Honourable Gerry Brown.
I just note that the Minister did ask the opposition a question. She just got a lot of answers to her question. It wasn't disorderly. It was just complying with her request.
And my ruling was order. And my ruling was about my ability to hear, and I couldn't. I wasn't actually criticising the interjection. I know that happens, but when it gets to the point where I can't even hear the answer, then I can't make any rulings.
Speaker, would it be helpful then if just my one voice gave you the answer that you so you can hear it?
Well, it's up to parties if they want to have designated interjectors, but...
Supplementary.
Can I just... I really do... I think others might not have heard. I certainly didn't, so if the Honourable Dr Megan Wood could at least do the short version of it.
In answer to the member's question, as I recall it, is what I do accept is New Zealand is having to import a whole lot of coal this year, largely due to the failure of gas to play a reliable security of supply as a backup in a dry year.
Great answer.
Julian
supplementary. Does she think that all countries should listen to and take seriously the IEA, when it says to achieve net zero emissions by 2050, governments must stop issuing permits for new oil and gas projects, as well as coal, immediately?
Mr Speaker, in answer to the first part of that member's question, that member can take a great deal of pride in the fact that she was a minister in a government that actually got out in front of that report and banned the issuing of new exploration permits for oil before that report appeared. That this is a government that continues to understand the challenges that we have ahead of us and the courageous steps that need to be taken.
That's right. Supplementary.
What advice has she received about the impact of new oil and gas developments on our pathway to net zero emissions by 2050?
Mr Speaker, there are many reports that show the pathways that we need to take, not least of all the Independent Climate Commission's report that shows that New Zealand has to move away from using fossil fuels, whether they be coal or gas, if we are to reach our climate goals. And this is an obligation that this government takes seriously, and why, as Minister of Energy, I was proud to lead the ending of the issuing of new exploration permits for oil and gas.
Supplementary.
Will she rule out further permits for new fossil fuel developments, be they oil, gas or coal, as per the International Energy Agency's strong recommendation to all countries?
Mr Speaker, as I indicated to the member in the answer to a previous question, that there are a range of factors that have to be taken into consideration, security of supply, but these will all need to be considered in the context of the government considering how it puts together carbon budgets leading over the next few months.
That's
a win for Indonesia. Kia ora. When will block offers for exploration permit on land end as desired by Taranaki Iwi?
Mr Speaker, as I also indicated in the answer to a previous supplementary question, that when the previous government, made up of the Labor Party, New Zealand First and the Green Party, made the decision to end offshore permitting, we gave an undertaking to undertake onshore block offers in 2018, 19 and 20. And as I indicated, no decisions have been made around further considerations. And one of the factors that I indicated that would need to be taken into account would be the views of local iwi.
Question number 9, Barbara Edmonds.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. To the Minister of Transport, what recent announcements has been made on bringing New Zealand's rail network back up to scratch?
The Honourable Michael Wood.
Mr Speaker, I'm very pleased to confirm the government is delivering on its commitment to bring New Zealand's rail network back up to scratch and support our economic recovery. KiwiRail's inaugural rail network investment program was released today, which details renewals and upgrades on the rail network over the next 3 years. The disruptions to the supply chain due to COVID have shown how important it is to have a reliable rail network to keep freight flowing and keep our economy moving.
Supplementary. What does the program include?
Mr Speaker, the $1.3 billion investment is about getting the bread and butter stuff done to lift our rail network to a resilient and reliable state after years of managed decline. It includes fully replacing 20 bridges around the country and improving around 25 more, replacing more than 200 kilometres of rail sleepers, more than 130 kilometres of tracks, adding active controls like barrier arms, lights and bells to three-level crossings, upgrading the Auckland Metro network, and importantly, investing in a business case for further network improvements across Wellington, including looking at potentially expanding commuter services to the north of Waikanae.
Supplementary. How will this work support the economic recovery?
Mr Speaker, this work is enabling KiwiRail to take on around 150 new track staff, including a pipeline of trainees, and will also support numerous civil contracting firms and material suppliers. There will be work happening across every region, from Northland to Southland, supporting jobs and the economic recovery across our country.
Our supplementary, the Honourable Michael Woodhouse.
To the Minister, do those announcements include plans to improve the Te Huia rail service, where recent analysis has shown that the average passenger could each take a double cab ute and drive to Auckland, resulting in half the emissions that the train does?
Mr Speaker, as the member knows, the government is committed to a 5-year start-up service for the Te Huia service to reconnect the Waikato and Auckland regions by rail. And I look forward to that member and his colleagues campaigning to scrap that service at the 2023 election, if that's what they wish to do. Yeah, yeah.
We come to question number 10, Christopher Luxon.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Transport. Does he stand by all his statements and actions?
The Honourable Michael Wood.
Mr. Speaker, yes, in particular that our government is continuing to take action to tackle transport emissions to meet our 2050 carbon neutral target when I announced the extension of the road user charge exemption for light electric vehicles this week.
What is his response to Auckland Mayor Phil Goff, who said the Eastern Busway two-year delay was, quote, an unpleasant surprise to most of us on the council, and we're not at the end of the story yet?
Mr. Speaker, I agree with Mayor Goff. It was a surprise to a number of us when Auckland Transport made that comment. It's important to note that the only reason that the Eastern Busway is proceeding is because this government committed to the regional fuel tax, which is enabling that project to be delivered, something that that side of the House voted against. So if Mr. Luxon is now saying that he wants that project to proceed more quickly, I welcome the National Party's commitment to the regional fuel tax.
Is it a priority of this government for NZTA to enable councils to complete critical projects like the Eastern Busway? And if so, why is the busway being delayed by a further 2 years?
Mr. Speaker, it is an absolute priority. And in the case of that particular project, I think I agree with the member that actually delivering high-quality public transport services to the east of Auckland is a major priority. It's been neglected for many, many years. It is only this government which has put that project actually on into the ATAP plan and put funding in place. I've asked Waka Kotahi officials to work with Auckland Transport to bring the project forward and deliver it as quickly as possible.
Does he believe the Eastern Busway being delayed 2 years is fair on the 130,000 East Aucklanders who have been paying a regional fuel tax for 3 years, yet remain without any adequate public transport options connecting them to Greater Auckland?
Mr. Speaker, as the member knows, and I think all Auckland members will know, there is considerable work to do to make sure that Auckland has the linked-up public transport system that it deserves. The regional fuel tax is an important part of that. It is important to note that stage one of that project is in fact opening later this month, so progress is being made. We have funded the project within ATAP, something that the previous government didn't do, and we'll work as quickly as we can to deliver that important project.
Which of these should be a higher priority? An Eastern Busway connecting 30,000 people a day to education and employment, or a $785 million cycle bridge carrying 3,000 people at most on a good sunny day?
Mr. Speaker, the government believes that in order to deliver the transport solutions that Aucklanders and New Zealanders need, we do need to be able to do more than one thing at once. And I do note that under the current plans, the Eastern Busway will be delivered within the next 5 years far quicker than any plan under that previous government.
Members, we come to question number 11, Karen Chaw.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Prevention of Family and Sexual Violence. Does she stand by the statement on 20th of May 2021 that, quote, we are truly committed to having a safer Aotearoa New Zealand for all, and especially for women and our tamariki, end quote?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Marama Davidson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I am really grateful for this question. Yes, I do, because it is so important. We have shifted and must continue to shift our approach and thinking on how we address and prevent family violence and sexual violence in Aotearoa. We are doing this through successive steps since 2017, through funding, initiatives, legislative reforms, and our commitment as a government to join up the public service. Mr. Speaker, and critically for me, as a newly appointed minister in this role, I have met with people, with victims and survivors, with whānau and the sector who have been at the forefront and expertise of doing this work. I have met with judges, I have met with iwi, I have met with people who use violence and are perpetrators of violence, and they have all, with the research and evidence, been very, very clear, Mr. Speaker, that it is whānau-centred and community-led responses.
Order. I think the member has definitely addressed the question. Karen Chaw.
How would she respond to the OECD report in December 2020, which found that New Zealand has the highest rate of intimate partner violence against women in the OECD.
And that is unacceptable. And around the world, all countries have struggled with reducing the prevalence of harm and have not been able to interrupt the intergenerational nature of violence. This is why in budgets 17, 18, 19, 20 and budget 21, we committed to services like whānau-centred facilitated responses with kaupapa Māori providers to wrap support around to prevent and provide safe responses to harm. Why we provided funding towards communities and whānau to support parents to reduce risk and be the safest whānau possible for all children. Why in Budget 21...
Supplementary. Why has the number of family harm incidents increased under this government from 133,000 in 2018 to 171,000 in 2020?
Firstly, I dispute the numbers that the member is putting forward. Secondly, we are focusing on primary prevention. That is the commitment that this government has put into this work. It is primary prevention over sustained years that will eventually bring the harm and prevalence down. We have international research and other research that shows that it can take up to 6 to 10 years plus of sustained resourcing on primary prevention before we finally will start to see any reduction in the prevalence of harm. If the member is interested, the Australian Prevention Agency called Our Watch tells us that the prevalence of violence drops after committed up to and plus 10 years plus of strengthened primary prevention infrastructure and investment. We have not seen that from any of the successive governments over the terms. The first time we are doing that is now.
Thank you. Debbie Ngāre will take it.
What is she doing to increase funding and resources for kaupapa Māori providers on the front line responding to whānau violence?
I am so grateful for all of these questions, including what we have heard from the sector and the people that says that tangata whenua leadership an authentic partnership with government, that resourcing tangata whenua and kaupapa Māori prevention and services are vital to shifting and eliminating the prevalence of family violence and sexual violence. We have committed to $12 million in Budget 21 and previously, and before the end of the year, a national strategy and action plans will be launched, which will include more actions to uplift kaupapa-led prevention and support services.
Supplementary.
Karen Chul.
So is she confident that due to the actions she has taken, there will be a reduction in family harm incidences, and I won't have to stand here next year and ask this question again?
As I have just pointed out, it will take 6 to 10 plus years of all of us in this House, of all of the members in this House committing to ongoing focus in primary prevention. I invite all of the members to be on board this commitment and this vision, which has not happened until this government put in place a lead minister for this work. I invite all members to support the long-term work which the sector and the experts have continued to uphold. This is intergenerational work, Mr. Speaker, and I ask all of us to commit to the enduring form of this work.
Question number 12, in the name of Camilla Balich. Jenna, quick.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister for Food Safety, what action is the government taking to prevent spina bifida and similar conditions?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Dr. Aisha Vera.
Today I was pleased to announce that New Zealand will move to the mandatory fortification with folic acid of non-organic bread-making wheat flour. Mr. Speaker, this move is about protecting babies. Folic acid is safe and it is essential to the healthy development of babies early in pregnancy. Low folate levels in mothers cause neural tube defects that result in the deaths of babies in the womb or cause lifelong disability. New Zealand's rate of neural tube defects remains too high compared to other countries such as Australia, the United States and Canada that have already implemented mandatory fortification.
Supplementary. How many neural tube defects will be prevented thanks to fortification?
Mr. Speaker, it's estimated that fortifying all non-organic wheat flour for making bread could prevent between 162 and 240 neural tube defects over 30 years. Of particular note, when we look at the experience of Australia that implemented this policy, the benefits were particularly seen in women who were pregnant as teenagers and Indigenous women.
Supplementary. What reaction has she seen to today's announcement?
Oh, Mr. Speaker, a very positive reaction. The Paediatric Society of New Zealand has welcomed the announcement, saying voluntary fortification of some breads has been ineffective in reaching the at-risk population of pregnant women. Dr. Andrew Marshall, clinical leader of child health at Wellington Hospital, said this announcement will finally allow New Zealand to join Australia and most of the rest of the world in fortifying food in a way that reaches the whole population. I'd also note the earlier comments from the College of Public Health Medicine, which believes fortification could also help prevent as many as 200 miscarriages a year in pregnancy. Mr. Speaker, folic acid is safe, proven and effective. Adding it to non-organic bread-making flour will make a real difference to the health of mothers and well-being of babies.
Our members, that concludes oral questions.